Accession number 30018, Reel 6.
John Harley, Reel 6. I believe that obviously, once you'd finished with the squadron, you went on to Central Flying School. Could you explain the reasoning behind that?
Yes, I wanted to go to CFS for two reasons. It was quite clear they weren't going to let me go to the Empire Test Pilot School unless I got more flying experience. And I didn't want to just bore holes in the sky, which is what I saw the Hunter squadrons doing in Germany at that time, because for the reasons I've mentioned, I didn't think they were going to be very competitive if we actually had a punch-up. I mean, that was just the state of our kit in 1958 and 9 time. But teaching somebody to fly struck me as a real job. That probably meant I wasn't your sort of typical extrovert fighter pilot who couldn't see any point in doing anything like that, you know, any more than some of the old-fashioned coppers could see any point about teaching in a college, you know, police college. They wanted to go out and kick heads. And anyway, I didn't feel that way, and it seemed to me very good in terms of a worthwhile job to teach somebody to fly. So off I went. I went to CFS, and I was put on the advanced course, which is where you're going to take students who have done their basic flying, and in those days they have finished their piston engine flying and so on. They haven't got their wings, and then they are going to go on to some advanced aeroplane on which they will get their wings. So you have a different syllabus for advanced flying and so on, and I just come off a Hunter squadron, so they decided to make me an advanced pilot. Fine, no argument with that. The aircraft that was used for teaching basic flying in those days was the Jet Provost, the jet version of the aeroplane that I'd flown. And there was a certain amount of flying to be done on the Jet Provost at CFS with your instructor before you went on to the advanced aeroplane at CFS, which was the Vampire. So a sort of a little bit of a sort of what do you call these courses where you get all the students on the same level, you know, whatever the courses are, introductory course or you know, the first term or so of university or anywhere. A consolidation, or I don't know what the term is. Anyhow, off we went to do this. Now, I was keen to teach the chap to fly, and we're talking about land here, using the techniques that were necessary in a Hunter, because that was more representative of an operational airplane than the Jet Provost was. Now, when you get on the approach to land, there are two ways in which you can control the aircraft. The traditional way, taught in the First World War, was to control the glide path with the throttle. In other words, how fast the airplane is coming down is controlled by how much power you carry. And the speed of the airplane is controlled by the control column, the stick. Now, I think that sort of technique goes back to the days when all aeroplanes, we're talking First World War, all aeroplanes did what were called glide approaches. The chap set himself up a mile or two before the airfield, he closed the throttle, and he glided down to the airfield. And there were techniques to change your rate of descent. If you were too high, you deliberately put on rudder and made the airplane go sideways, which generated drag, and so the thing sank more. If you were a little bit on the low side, you opened the throttle. It gave it a bit blip of power, so the airplane didn't come down so fast. So this technique of sort of modifying a glide approach with blips of power was still hanging around. Sorry about that. So this business of how they used to control the approach with piston engine airplanes is all very well, but it doesn't work with a jet airplane. Especially the early jet airplanes that which we were flying in those days. The engine response is very slow, and when you increase the throttle after a little while, you will get some extra thrust. And this did nothing for the glide path. You know, you're you're coming down, you decide you're a little bit on the low side, you want to correct back up to the correct angle of approach, you want something that works pretty quickly. And opening the throttle on the Hunter just made it go faster. It didn't do anything to the direction it was travelling in. And so we were only able to survive on the Hunter by using the throttle to control speed and the stick to control glide path. In other words, the opposite of what was taught in the First World War and was had persisted through Air Force teaching. And indeed, I was aware of this problem, this sort of philosophical problem about how should you control an airplane on the approach and the way it was changing with new types of airplane. I was familiar with that in 1958, the first year I was on my squadron, because there was an article published in Air Clues about, and Air Clues was the RAF magazine, if you like, which was primarily a flight safety tool and discussed people's accidents and mistakes and things that went wrong and so on. And there was an article about approach handling, and they concluded, they, the editorial side of Air Clues, concluded that this chap had landed short in his jet aeroplane and hit the grass and then bumped into the beginning of the concrete and broke the undercarriage off, you know, that sort of thing. They concluded that it was because he'd used the wrong approach technique. And I wrote an article to Air Clues saying that I didn't agree with this, and that they had specifically said that for him to pull the stick back at the final stages was a no-hoper. Well, and I went through the maths and explained why it was the only thing he could do at that stage. And I got a very nice reply, published in the next thing of Air Clues, and then I was supported by a then test pilot working for the Blind Landing Experimental Unit, who wrote an article in the next version of Air Clues about the way I wanted to do it and how they have been using that method with autopilots. Because when the Boffins came to look at automatic landing of aeroplanes, which was now just happening in the mid-50s or late-50s, they had to say, which way are we going to ask the autopilot to do it? You know, like the World War II or like this newfangled idea? So, anyway, I had strong views about this. But I could not make any headway at all with my instructor. He was a flight sergeant. He was a god. He'd survived all through the Second World War, you know. He obviously was a very experienced and talented, because people had to be talented to survive in those days. The airplanes had bad handling characteristics and the enemy was shooting at you. So he was undoubtedly got a tremendous background and reputation and so on, but he would not hear of this newfangled idea that you open the throttle to control the speed. He would not hear of it. And I couldn't get any sensible conversation going with him on the ground. So one day in the air, I was a bit naughty, and I was playing the student and he was playing the instructor, because sometimes you reverse the roles depending on what was being taught and so on. And I got us deliberately low and deliberately slow on short finals in our jet provost over the beginning of the lead-in lights at Little Rissington. And I stopped flying the aeroplane and I looked across at my instructor and I said, "Sir, could you please show me how you push the stick forward to get the speed back?" You see? Well, I mean, he couldn't push the stick forward to get the speed back because we were too low. So he did what I would have done. He just opened the throttle, you see, and pulled the stick back. Exactly what this chap had done when he'd hit the grass. He'd done it too late, in my view, but, you know, that was the only thing to do. And he wouldn't, my instructor wouldn't speak to me again. You see, he just flew the airplane back to base and we landed, and he refused point blank to speak to me again because I made him look a bloody idiot. So I was given a new instructor, and I got on extremely well with a new guy who was a completely undecorated post-Second World War sharp aviator, you know, who wanted to use the sort of technique that I was talking about. So at this time, all I'm saying is that about this time, between 1955 and 1960, there was a changeover period going on at CFS about some of these fundamentals of how you control an aeroplane.
Did those views get very
entrenched from that kind of generation who were in the Second War because of what they'd done?
Oh, I think so. You'd be surprised how conservative a lot of flying instructors are. I mean, quite properly so. And in fact, how conservative pilots are. And they have every right to be conservative because, you know, they have learned what they've learned the hard way, and they don't like it. It works for them, whatever it is, and because this isn't the only thing that was contentious. So yeah, pilots are conservative, and I've no doubt that the early ones who were taught to listen to the wind in the wires to judge their speed, which is how people did, First World War, beginning of, then somebody comes along with this newfangled piece of equipment called an airspeed indicator, you see, and they want you to look at the needle on this gauge to tell how fast you're going. Well, you can imagine some of the hairy old experienced people saying, oh, I'm not going to trust that newfangled bit of kit, you know, I listen to the wind in the wires, you know. And they would have died at some stage trying to listen to the wind in the wires, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, I think pilots have always been conservative about new equipment and new techniques, and possibly understandably so.
And that, I take it, was less of a problem for you because you were coming to it in a sense of relatively new to the thing, and you were interested in the processes.
Yes, true. I was new to it, but I'd also had my 5 years at Farnborough, where, you know, I was brought up as a young lad from 17 to 22. 1955, yes, 22 and a half. I was brought up as a young lad, those very impressionable years, by thinking scientists and engineers, not people stamping out a process, you know, the Jobsworth sort of approach to something. I've been brought up and exposed to some of the best aeronautical minds in the United Kingdom for 5 years. So I wanted to think, you know, about what we were doing. I didn't just accept what I was told to do. Now, in the services, of course, anybody who questions what you're told to do can be very bad news. I mean, you know, the services are not, and don't exist to have the youngsters question their elders and betters. And in many regards, of course, there's good reasons for this. But when it comes to something as technical as operating some new category of aeroplane, and essentially I guess the services today, all three of them have been changed by the influence of technology and the need to just stop shouting at people and swearing at them, because they've got to be bright, they've got to use kit, and they need to be treated in a slightly different way, a more logical and effective way for dealing with intelligent thinking people, because that's what our they're all volunteer services are. We don't have any national service now, so they're all volunteers, and they're in general they're high quality thinking people compared to the quotes cannon fodder unquote, you know, that used to go into the services a century ago. Anyhow, we're getting away from the point. CFS was extremely interesting, and apart from this brief interlude, I got on very with that first instructor. I got on very well with my next guy, who was brilliant.
Could you explain to me how that worked, John, with the instructors? What you know, the kind of pattern of training that you were receiving at that level, what you were doing with them?
Yes, well, the standard technique for instructing people, and I guess it's appropriate, whatever it is you're instructing them to do, is you brief them to start with. You sit them down and you talk to them about what it is we're going to do, whether it be driving a motor car or flying an airplane or using a typewriter, you know. You've got to talk to them. And then you probably are going to demonstrate a stage. And then you're going to say, well, why don't you try that sort of thing? And so, I mean, that's the fundamental process of education, isn't it, and training, especially if it's on a one-to-one basis, the instructor talks about it, the instructor demonstrates, and the instructor lets the student try, and then the instructor offers advice, on how to overcome any particular problems or mistakes that the student is now making. So that's the essential process. Now, remember, what we were doing at CFS was teaching people to be instructors, not teaching them to fly as such. Although there would have been a degree of what's known in the trade as standardization, where you're trying to get people to use the same techniques and the same approach to things. And when they come from different backgrounds into CFS, there is a degree of sort of normalization or standardization that needs to be done to get them all to the same basic level of pilots and RAF pilots at that, and then you start teaching them to be instructors along using some well-established process. And don't forget, the Central Flying School was the first flying school in the world. I mean, we're talking, the RAF always has led the way in terms of flying instruction, and led the way in the world, no question about it. And that's not just waving the flag sort of thing, it's a matter of fact. That's the basic process. But because the instructors were teaching you how to be an instructor and not just teaching you how to fly, there were times when they would play being a student. So the instructor sits down in the classroom, you brief him on what we're going to do, and then you would get airborne and you would demonstrate what we were going to do. And then you'd say, okay, Bloggs, you have control, now try and do that. And he would do it, he, the instructor, would do it with some deliberate mistake put in, and you would say, no, Bloggs, you know, and I have control again. So you were taught some fundamental things, and one of the most important things was never talk to the chap when he's flying the aeroplane. In other words, if you want to say something significant to him, I don't mean speak to him, I mean but make some point about what's going on, then you take control. So he can just sit there and listen to you. Otherwise, as a young, inexperienced pilot, he's struggling to keep control of the airplane. His brain's only half on what you're saying. So there were techniques that were taught on how to instruct. And then we had this role-playing that we did. And it was on such an occasion as that, when I was a student making mistakes, and he was going to show me the classic way that the instructor should address these mistakes and debrief the student. That was the process. Nothing terribly amazing about it, but it was very effective. And anyhow, I enjoyed it, and at the end of it all, I passed the course. And in the way of things, one was gathering around the notice board to see where your postings were.
Could I ask how you were examined on the course, John?
Yes. They have, at all stages of the course, it was a 3 months course, as I recall, you would get the odd flight commander check. In other words, the school was set up with a number of flights. Inside the flight, there were a number of instructors. And depending on who your instructor was, if you had a very junior instructor, then you would probably be checked more frequently by the flight commander. Whether you were at a flying training school or CFS, I mean, the principle was the same. If, on the other hand, your instructor was one of the most experienced ones in the flight, then probably you wouldn't fly with anybody else, because the system would take its word for you. You wouldn't fly with anybody else until you came to some formal, what was normally called the final handling test, where you go off with somebody you have not flown with before, somebody who is going to examine you in your techniques and your abilities. And so that was usually the squadron commander or the flight commander. Occasionally the wing commander would do the odd student, but that was the process of how you were examined. Nothing surprising about it at all. No problem with it.
When you went up with them, would you have to use some form of patter to explain what you were doing?
Oh, very much so. I mean, this business of being taught to be an instructor as opposed to being taught to fly, you were required to stamp out, that's the wrong sort of word, you were required to use prescribed patter. They didn't like initiative being demonstrated by this, you know, instructor to be. No, you had to push out the company line on instruction, and that was fine. I mean, why not? You've got to have standardization of instruction, otherwise you're not going to get any sort of standard product out of the end of a school, are you? So yeah, that was fine. I mean, it was really that point I made about how you control the airplane on an approach. The standardisation at that time was that you use throttle to control rate of descent, and I didn't like that, and wanted to be part of... I think there must have been a groundswell of change building up at that time. But in the end, of course, you do what your instructor says, don't you? And on any course, otherwise you're just going to get thrown off.
Well, I'm wondering about that, because obviously, in a sense... You didn't do what your instructor wanted, did you, on that?
And yeah, well, he took action, and, you know, and his obvious action was, well, I'm not going to get anywhere with this bloke, you know. I don't want to have any more to do with him, because, you know, he's... So, and I was then given one of the other instructors who clearly had my view, and I'm quite sure that the instructor base must have had their own debates in the crew room about this. And in the end, I mean, this is pure imagination on my part. In the end, I imagine they probably said, well, as long as the bloke flies the approach accurately, do we really care which technique he's used, you see? And then there would have been, oh, we must patter this, or those that said, no, we must patter that. But in the end, they probably agreed to disagree, if you like, with, well, as long as they fly it accurate enough. But if they don't fly it accurate enough, they can't pass, you know. That's guesswork on my part.
Because I was thinking, because obviously we were talking about the changes that were occurring, and that seems to me at some stage that could have caused quite a lot of trouble for you if you'd not been viewing the kind of prescribed thing in that level.
Sure.
For them to change an instructor seems to imply some form of thought again into the changing situation.
Yeah. Somebody must have accepted that I had a point. I wasn't just a bullshit student. Yes. Anyhow, everything else, as far as I'm concerned, one just learnt the pattern and stamped it out. And there's much more to flying, of course, than just controlling an aircraft on the approach.
What about the Jet Provost as an aircraft? Could you give me your impression of that as a trainer?
The throttle on the Jet Provost was supposed to give you more noise, and that's about all. It was by jet aeroplane standards, it was a very underpowered aeroplane. And it was, in fact, this is the Jet Provost 3, it was, in fact, a perfectly reasonable jet trainer, as far as I'm concerned. The philosophy at the time was, we want to teach people to fly jet aeroplanes, eventually on the squadrons, they're all going to be jet aeroplanes, therefore we'll teach them to fly on a jet aeroplane. As opposed to have to convert them from a propeller to a jet, because there were some fundamental differences between the two classes of aeroplane. And I thought the Jet Provost was a fine aeroplane. But when it came to the end of the course, I was expecting to be posted as a vampire advanced instructor, because I had spent most of my time on the vampire, and when I had the instructor change and so on, I was on the vampire throughout. And I did my final handling test as an advanced instructor, and I was signed up as such in my logbook, etc., etc. So we're all gathered around the notice board to find our postings, and I was posted as a basic flying instructor on Jet Provost to the RAF College at Cranwell. So I was going to do a job that I hadn't really been trained for. I'd been trained to do the advanced stuff, and I suppose people could say, well, if you can fly advanced, or if you can do advanced whatever it is, you won't have any trouble with basics, whatever it is, by definition. But it's not quite like that, because the sort of pattern, the sort of exercises that you had to demonstrate your competence in were not, on the advanced side, were not the ones that you had to push out for a student. None of this discussion about should he go solo, or, you know, all of this sort of stuff. Was quite different. So, I mean, I thought, oh, well, you know, I didn't particularly mind being sent as a basic instructor, But I was a bit surprised, and I thought I was going to be pretty ill-equipped to do that job. Well, when we finished the course, we all had a one-to-one interview with the commandant and an Air Commodore, and I went in and sat down, you know, well, what do you think of the course, Farley? Well, I thought it was a bit of a waste of time, sir. Well, he was not expecting that, of course. And he wasn't, and he was so surprised. He just said, "Why?" I said, "Well, I've done the advanced course, and I've been posted to do the basic instructor's job." And he looked at the paperwork, and he said, "Well, that's what the Air Force wants you to do." But you know, you don't get any sensible response to what I imagine was probably some sort of administrative mess up. I don't know. Maybe they had done their sums wrong and they needed a lot more basic instructors than they did advanced instructors. And after all, I had done a little on the Jet Provost. But I was standardised and turned into a Jet Provost instructor when I first arrived at Cranwell, because I think, I can't remember now, 2 or 3 weeks I was with what was called Standards Flight, which was a small bunch of very experienced instructors that all the flying training schools had. Standards Flight, the name speaks for itself. This is where we set our standards. This is where we standardise people. And so I was given a very quick sort of rush through the whole syllabus, and I was totally happy. And indeed, I enjoyed this concept that you take somebody who can only ride a bicycle, and 6 weeks later you've sent him solo, and a month later you send him off by himself with one of Her Majesty's aeroplanes to go to some station he's never been to before, land the aeroplane there, get it turned round by the ground crew there, it's called a landaway navex, get back in the aeroplane, flight plan it, and get back in and bring it back to base. And so the lad comes back from his land away now action, you think, well, we've got somewhere with him, you know.
What was the syllabus that you were teaching? What were the kind of pattern of instruction that you were giving in this basic stage of instruction? Did it vary from what you'd experienced yourself?
No, because the business of learning to fly is the business of learning to fly. You've got to teach people the effects of controls. What do you do to make the airplane go left? What do you do to make it go right? Up, down, faster, slower? How do you control the thing in level flight? Exercise one, sort of, it's not one, but I mean a very early exercise, is what's called straight and level, where you literally teach the student to try and stay in a particular direction and at a particular height. You know, that's the... So, and you go from there into turning and climbing and descending and then eventually into the circuit and then into aerobatics and stalling and spinning and whatever. You know, you can break the syllabus of the different manoeuvres that an aircraft can do down in that way. So whether you are teaching... whether you're teaching basic or advanced, you've still got to cover all of those aspects. Although in the case of teaching somebody to fly straight and level in a vampire, you'd expect that to take perhaps a minute, because the person has got a level of competence. But, you know, the same fundamental things. It might take a bit longer than a minute, because in actual fact, when you start flying at the speeds that jet aeroplanes do, a very, very small error in pitch, attitude, and what the view looks like out the window, the nose is a fraction too high or a fraction too low, excuse me, then you get a tremendous rate of climb or a tremendous rate of descent out of it. So, although the exercise is basically the same, it's much more sensitive and critical in a high-speed aeroplane.